I really appreciate being asked to be a part of this program. As a veterinarian in practice, I think I attended the very first one of these reproductive conferences. It was in Manhattan, Kansas, and at the time I was trying to sort out all these different estrus synchronization plans, and I thought that's kind of why I was going to the meeting, and I did get that, but I got so much more out of it, and so much more that I could help my clients with. And I see a lot of veterinarians in the room here today, and I think those of you guys who have your vet here in the room should feel proud of that these guys are coming to get this kind of continuing education, this good quality continuing education, that they're here to get that information and be connected with the industry and the things you do. So it's great to see that. I thought I'd just give you a little nostalgia for what snow looked like. That picture was not taken this year, unfortunately, in this room or in this part of the country. I want to go over a little bit about what I'm going to talk about here, components of a biosecurity plan. We're going to talk about managing infectious reproductive diseases. And so we're going to talk a little bit about biosecurity, some other management considerations we're going to throw in there. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some specific diseases and realize for all those diseases that I have listed on that slide, I probably take a good 2 or 3 hours in the infectious diseases, animal diseases class that I teach at SDSU to teach the students about them, and I'm going to cover them in 1 or 2 slides. So there's a lot more detail in the proceedings book, and I would refer you to that information there. Well, when we talk about infectious reproductive diseases, these can be very tricky to deal with on a number of levels. First of all, not all of them affect the same stage of pregnancy. Sometimes we're talking about infectious diseases that can affect, you know, everywhere from conception to mid-gestation to late gestation, late-term abortions, that kind of thing, and even affect cattle. Calves born after, affect calves after they're born, and where it shows up in the calves after they're born. So it's that whole continuum. We have diagnostic difficulties with this, with some of these syndromes, and we have excellent diagnosticians at the diagnostic lab. I have my office in the diagnostic lab at SDSU. But the fact is, with some of these viruses, some of these bacteria, they do the insult, you know, to the fetus and to the pregnancy, and then there's kind of a delay time a lot of times before that fetus is expelled in the case of like a late-term abortion. And so by the time we see that fetus out on the ground, that infectious disease agent might not be around anymore. So it makes it a little more difficult to diagnose some of these issues versus things like respiratory disease or calf scours or some of the things we normally deal with. We have the potential for significant losses. And so much of our conference to this point has been talking about how can we improve conception rate, you know, 5 to 7% or pregnancy rate or whatever it is. Well, not the things I'm going to talk about, the management things and the vaccination programs and those kind of things are not going to be things where we can vaccinate animals and get that kind of a boost in percentage. What we're talking about here and what I think me and the veterinarians in the room want to really do for you as producers is take the animal health issues off the table. Avoid that big, huge disaster that can occur because of some of these infectious reproductive diseases. And every one of the veterinarians in this room can probably tell you a story about some wreck that's happened because of trichomoniasis. You know, we're talking about, you know, pregnancy rates. We like, you know, when we go out and preg check a group of animals, we'd like to have, you know, 10% open, something like that. How about 20% open, 40% open, 50% open? That's what trichomoniasis has done to herds that it's infiltrated. So we have the potential for some really devastating things to happen here. And what we want to do is kind of take those risk management. We want to take those things off of the table. And so it's critical to try to keep problems out of our herds whenever possible. And that's what we're going to talk about with biosecurity. Now, I put this picture up in a lot of the talks I give, and in students that I interact with have seen this probably ad nauseum, but it's what I call the epidemiologic triad, and it reminds me and it reminds us that there's more to infectious diseases than just the animal and just the bug. All right, there's the environment involved, and in the middle is this whole thing called management and what we do, and that's going to be what I'm going to talk about for the first part of this talk anyway. You know, at the diagnostic lab, we're so, and as veterinarians too, sometimes we're guilty of getting that to report back, and we'll find that bug, and we're going to figure out, okay, what can we do to, you know, get an antibiotic against that bacteria or a vaccine against that virus without thinking about all the other things that influence animal diseases. So just keep that in mind as we kind of go through. I'm going to talk about biosecurity, and it's a term you've probably all heard of, but biosecurity to me just simply boils down to we've got a herd of animals, a group of animals, a population of animals. What can we do to make sure that something new that could potentially be a hazard for an infectious disease, what can we do to keep that out of our herds? You know, for as much as we talk about visitor traffic and vehicles and equipment and all those things are important, but, you know, they probably pale in comparison to the number of times that we introduce a new infectious agent by just the animals we buy. In other words, we're buying diseases sometimes that come onto our place. We actually purchase those animals that come with it. So we're going to kind of focus on that. And we can kind of look at a continuum here. We've got the continuum from, you know, buying the heifers at the auction or at the farm and just dumping them right in with the rest of our animals. And then on the other hand, we got Fort Knox here where you can't hardly get into it because of the biosecurity. Now, those of you who have anything to do with swine operations know which end of the continuum they're on. They're over here. You know, they would never dream of somebody running a sow farm would never dream of backing up the trailer, you know, and just dumping those sows in with the existing sows in their operation. So, where do you fit into this continuum? And I'm going to try to kind of get you some answers that might help you kind of figure some of that out as we go on. So, we'll break down this biosecurity to some components. And first of all, I want to talk about the first component is just actually doing homework. How much do you know about the individual animals that you're bringing into a herd if you're doing it, whether it's bred heifers, bred cows, open heifers, bulls? How much do you know about those animals? Testing programs. If you're working with a private treaty organization or a bull sale or an auction, somebody selling these animals, how much do you know about their testing programs, for example? And what are their testing programs for infectious diseases? What do they actually comprise? It's important to have some detail about that because for some diseases, a test on an individual animal isn't worth much. I'm not going to talk about it here, but Yoni's disease is an example of a disease. If I have an individual test on a young bull or a young heifer, we know that that doesn't really mean too much. For that kind of a disease, we need a herd approach, a herd testing approach from the source that we're getting the animals. Other things like BVD, persistent infection, yeah, that individual test means a lot. And so we'll get into a little bit more detail about that. What vaccination programs does the source herd have? What kind of herd performance have they experienced? And you can tell right now, you know, buying things in auction markets, going to the sale barn, just kind of going to see what you get, you're not going to have a lot of access to some of this information all the time. I put up vet-to-vet consultations, and I've been involved in some of these, I would say, you know, more so on the swine side of things rather than the cattle. But think about if you know that that you're going to be buying heifers from an operation, ask if your vet can have a conversation with their veterinarian. And now what I'm not getting at is here, you know, have a conversation. You tell your vet to really find out how those cattle are doing or what actual disease problems these has. But it's more of a thing, well, okay, here's our vaccination program, here's our testing program. If your vet talks to their vet, a lot of times you'll have those details kind of worked out and have a better plan on how you can incorporate those animals into your herd. So that's what I'm getting at with the vet-to-vet consultations. So first of all is the homework. And then we get to this issue about isolation and quarantine. And what we're talking about here is having a separate area and a separate time for new animals coming onto a farm to be separated from the rest of your animals. And we know from surveys, the NAM surveys will tell us that only about 33% of you, or 30% of you somewhere in there, ever do this with the animals you bring in, or do this, I should say, with all the animals you bring in. My more informal surveys, when I go out and talk to producer groups, is probably a lot less of people who segregate and isolate the animals that they bring into the farm for any kind of period of time. But what we want to consider here is that incoming animals, they're biological vectors. They're probably more of a source of infectious disease agents than any type of equipment or vehicle, any kind of inanimate object, although, you know, that we can have some important issues there too. But we can have new organisms that you're not used to dealing with on your farm, or your animals aren't used to immunologically dealing with on your farm. We've got the stress of transportation. Sometimes we're bringing in animals from a long ways away. We know that cortisol levels can increase the amount of shedding of organisms into the environment and possibly to other populations of animals. We've got all sorts of varying degrees of immunity. You know, how well were the incoming animals vaccinated versus yours, or vice versa? And the thing is, we don't buy sick animals. We don't buy outwardly sick animals, so they're not going to be showing us outward signs of illness. But still, we can have these things be a potential problem. So these are the considerations. Some things to think about when we're trying to figure out an isolation or quarantine facility and period. We want the physical separation. Ideally, we want no nose-to-nose contact between new animals and your existing herd for a period of time. We'd like separate runoff and drainage. Some of the infectious disease agents that we deal with are shed through the feces, so runoff and drainage becomes important. And equipment and instrument management, sharing those between groups is something we need to think about too. Then there's this question about the length of the isolation period. And I put up here 30 to 60 days, and you ask five other veterinarians, and they probably have a different idea about how long that isolation or quarantine phase should be. And this isn't something we're just pulling out of our hats. You know, for the most part, you know, transient, temporary infectious disease agents are probably going to be, you know, the new animals are going to be are going to stop shedding those organisms within a couple weeks usually. But we know that there's outliers, that animals can hang on to. We know that in certain cases hang on to things like BVD for much longer periods of time. So that's why we kind of go with the 30 to 60 day recommendation. And the truth of the matter really is as long as you practically can. You know, a couple weeks probably I'd say is the minimum. The longer the better. We want to give that animal, those new groups of animals, enough time to stop shedding these new organisms, but also time for all the other things that you want to do to those animals to get them ready to enter your herd successfully. And so that might be diagnostic testing. We're going to talk about some individual animal diseases where tests might be appropriate to use. When we think about testing new animals coming into our herd, we also have to have a plan. What if something goes wrong? And what if that animal that we spend a lot of money for actually turns up positive to a disease that we want to keep out? You know, what are we going to do in that case? So we have to have that plan in place in our mind already. Some of these, sometimes preventive antibiotic treatments can be a part of the incoming animal program. A lot of those are detailed in your proceedings, a little bit more detail. And then vaccination and acclimation. We want to make sure that the immune level of the incoming animals is roughly the same as the immune level of the animals we have in our herd existing already. So I said 30 to 60 days, but there are some disease syndromes for which you cannot isolate an animal long enough to get it to stop shedding the organism of note. One instance we're going to talk about is BVD, persistent infections with BVD. Those animals shed high levels of virus every single day of their life, and there's no length of isolation period is going to let them stop that shedding. Leptohargilbova, some of the host-adapted lepto strains will last a long time as carrier states. Trichomoniasis, once a bull's infected with trichomoniasis, we consider that bull to be infected for the rest of his life. Can't isolate these animals long enough, and so that's where diagnostic testing comes into play. And maybe it's taking that ear notch out of that new animal to test for BVD, persistent infection. Maybe it's something else, and we'll talk about those in the individual animal animal diseases. Preventive treatments, antibiotic treatments, and those kind of things. This is something we're really having a good conversation, good relationship with your veterinarian as far as what to use on these animals, what vaccines, what antibiotics, if any, that you need to be thinking about when looking at these incoming animals. So we've got the homework, we've got the isolation thing, a couple other things that we'll mention too, as part of a whole herd biosecurity, vaccination. And Dr. Chase is going to be on right after me and talk in more detail about vaccinations. But vaccination is not something that keeps an infectious agent out of your herd, but it sure will help provide a buffer and a barrier for spread of that new infectious agent through a herd if you do encounter that coming in. Environmental control. Some of these diseases, leptospirosis would be an example, have an environmental control factor in here too. So that's biosecurity. And I go into a couple of other discussions about just management of infectious diseases in the proceedings too. Some food for thought. I don't know how much of these things are very changeable in your own operations. But think about the group composition. You know, anytime we have the sheer number of animals that we're bringing into a herd, you know, bringing 25 heifers into a herd is different than bringing one bull into a herd just because of the sheer numbers and the differences in all those animals. The number of sources of new arrivals. Now we've got all sorts of different sources, different management styles that those animals have been raised in, different levels of immunity. If we want to have a uniform immune population, this makes things really tricky when we're bringing lots more animals in. One thing that I do think we can think about more frequently is segregating new animals, new reproductive animals in our herds from some higher risk groups. And I'm thinking mostly about, post-weaned feedlot calves, for example. Do we have our cows? Do we have our new heifers? Do we have them fence line contact where they can be in contact with some of this kind of age of animal? You know, this kind of age of animal is something that we're going to probably expect to be shedding a lot more things like IBR, BVD into the environment. And so is there a way that we can keep our reproductive herd, our bulls, our cows, our heifers, away from this potential higher risk source of infectious agents? Something to think about too. So here's the list of things that I do cover in the proceedings, and I'm going to talk about all but Vibrio and Neospora. Those you can kind of look through the proceedings, but this really is quite a variety of different agents. We've got some viruses there, we've got some bacteria there, we got a protozoa, we got some kind of unique bugs in there. And all of them kind of have their own different quirks, and all of them will affect reproduction in a different way. And so we go into each one of these diseases in terms of isolation and testing, vaccination, and environmental control in the proceedings here. And so we'll just kind of hit some of the highlights, and I hope this gives you a little food for thought to learn more about these syndromes, ask your veterinarian, refer to the proceedings and those kind of things. But we're going to talk about first about BVD, or bovine viral diarrhea. This is kind of an unfortunate name for a virus because when it was first discovered, that's what it did. It caused diarrhea in animals. Now we know that probably the most significant effects of BVD are reproduction. And I guess if there's any similarity to, or any appropriateness for the name now, bovine viral diarrhea, this disease really is the shits when you're talking about reproductive things, because it can cause everything from early embryonic death, low conception rates, all the way through persistently infected calves, birth defects, and then even after the calf is born, we can have congenitally affected calves as well, all because of this virus working on the reproductive tract of the female cow. Mostly we're talking about transmission being a fecal-oral kind of transmission, although the virus can be shed from a lot of different parts of the animal. But this is the key point when we're talking about BVD. Persistently infected animals are the reservoir for BVD in our cattle herds. If we didn't have this little quirk of this disease, I probably wouldn't be even mentioning this in this talk, because this is how it maintains itself in our cattle population. Persistently infected animal is something that's born from a cow. And this happens when this little fetus is developing inside this cow, and its mother inadvertently happens upon the BVD virus at just that right stage of gestation. And it's generally considered about 40 to 120 days of gestation when the cow encounters this virus. And so this cow, this virus gets into the cow's bloodstream, gets through the placenta into the fetus, and this fetus is busy kind of taking an immunological inventory of itself. It's making sure it knows what to respond to with its immune system and what to regard as foreign. Well, if that virus is in its system at that time, it regards BVD virus as part of itself. And so it incorporates this virus into itself, and it grows in the mother, and it's born. And when it hits the ground, it starts to secrete high doses of BVD virus to anything in its way. And it will do that for the rest of its life. It's not a thing that's going to kill a calf, kill all the calves, kill all the persistently infected calves right away, although these guys are generally more stunted and poor doers, more prone to have other diseases. But we do have instances where these persistently infected little calves can grow up to be heifers, can grow up to be cows and have calves, and grow up to be bulls, maybe a bull that you might buy at a sale someday. So that's the background of persistently infected animals for BVD. So these temporary infections, like the one that the cow encountered, they kind of deal with it and they get over it. And so our typical isolation period is going to be long enough to deal with these temporary BVD infections. But it's not going to be long enough for a persistently infected animal to stop shedding. So that's where our tests come into play. And the tests are very easy. I showed the picture of the ear notch, just a little clip out of the ear, and we get a skin sample. We submit it to the diagnostic lab, and they'll tell us if there's BVD virus in that clip of skin. And that tells us that there's that animal is persistently infected. We'll want to back it up with other tests in that. But it gives us the indication that animal is persistently infected. So I'm an advocate for anything you bring onto your place should be BVD tested for a persistently infected animal. Now, is it a very high chance that bull you bought at that nice sale that you paid him a lot of money for is persistently infected? Well, no, it's not a high probability thing. Same way with the heifers and the open cows that you might buy. It's a pretty low probability. But the test is easy, it's cheap, and if you happen to have one of those slip through your cracks, you have a potential for not just the next calving season problems, but years and years and years of reproductive problems, sick calves due to the immunosuppression that BVD can cause, lots of problems going forward. So for the cost of a $4 or $5 test, it's really cheap insurance. And so we'll do bulls, any open females coming in. The bred animals we bring into a herd are a special case because we can't test right now. We don't have a good way of testing that fetus inside that cow, who very well could be persistently infected, where that cow might not be and probably isn't persistently infected. So what we have to do with these bred heifers is keep them separate until they calve, get an ear notch out of that calf as soon as he hits the ground, and then determine whether those animals are BVD free. So bred animals, we have to be a little, there's that caveat there. It acts a little differently. And I think most of us will probably have some sort of a vaccination program in place for BVD. We should. It's out there. And so we want to keep our animals vaccinated pre-breeding wise for BVD. And manage the because it is a fecal-oral transmission, manage all those other exposures as well. Then we come to trichomoniasis. We just talked about a virus. This is actually trichomoniasis is actually a little one-celled protozoal animal that gets in and causes problems. It causes reproductive failure by causing an inflammation in the uterus. And when we have inflammation in the uterus, that little conceptus, that little embryo that's trying to gain a foothold and become a calf, is overtaken by this inflammation and is kind of removed from the body. So we usually see early embryonic death, maybe prolonged returns to estrus. Late abortions are generally unusual with trich, for the simple reason that trich usually starts in that animal's reproductive tract the same time that the animal becomes inseminated. So it's a venereal disease, and it's spread by bulls, and that's the reason why we have the problems with it. Bulls are lifelong carriers. They harbor this little protozoa in the crypts in the skin of their penis and their sheath. They can never get rid of it for all practical purposes. Well, they just can't get rid of it. Whereas cows will eventually clear the infection. So it's a venereal disease. And when we bring new animals in, because it's a venereal disease, if we bring in virgin bulls or virgin heifers or bred animals, cows that are confirmed pregnant, we can usually assume that they've had enough time to clear any infection, even if they would have been infected. If they are maintaining that pregnancy, they're probably pretty low risk for bringing trich in. Most of the time, if you bring in an animal from another place or another state, for sure, your testing is going to be taken care of, because we can't sell bulls, non-virgin bulls, without a trich test. And we're moving now to PCR tests, where we just take one smegma sample. We take a scraping out of the sheath of the bull, send that into the laboratory for what's called a PCR test, and we know whether it's infected or not, and we can go on. We're moving kind of away from the culture method, where you had to put it in the culture pouch and do three weekly tests, just because of the low sensitivity of that procedure. The PCR is a very sensitive way to test for it. There are vaccines out for trichomoniasis, but we got to understand that vaccines won't prevent infection, won't prevent that bull from infecting a cow. What they will do is decrease the amount of inflammation. More animals will be able to carry pregnancies on, and it will improve pregnancy rates in those animals, in infected herds. But I tell you what, it's much better to keep it out of a herd than it ever is dealing with it. And there's veterinarians in this room who have dealt with this up close and personal on a big-time level and can tell you stories. Let's go back to a virus, IBR, also known as red nose. IBR is a herpes virus. Anybody ever heard the term of the herpes viruses being the gift that keeps on giving? Well, that's the in cold sores and people, that's a herpes virus as well. IBR is in that same family of viruses. And what, you know, a cold sore virus does is lay dormant in your nerve cells in your neck and other parts of your body until you're stressed out. You know, the students I deal with at SDSU, the week before finals week, you know, that's the stress period, and you get a cold sore because of the recrudescence or the reactivation of that virus. And IBR is kind of the same way. You know, we usually kind of think of it as an acutely infectious kind of agent, but it does have that capability to lie dormant in the animal. It doesn't just cause red nose or the respiratory infection things in the animal, but we do know that it has reproductive effects as well. And what I mean by widespread evidence of infection, you know, we know that IBR is out there. It's a very widely vaccinated for virus, and so it's hard to find animals that are free or never exposed to IBR. So when we talk about in isolation for IBR to decrease the chance of bringing that into a herd, we got to consider a couple things. You know, there's a chance that we might have that circulating in our herds already. But also we got that little latency thing. An acutely infected, stressed animal that's stressed from transport, you know, this isolation period is going to be long enough. But we have that little question in the back of our minds, well, can it lie dormant and then be reactivated later on? And I say diagnostic testing is not useful because so many animals are exposed to it. So many animals would be positive for IBR if we went out and checked your herds. And they're, as such, they're a very integral part of most herd vaccination programs when we talk about adults pre-breeding as well as young feeder animals. talk a little bit about lepto as well. We have to realize we know now that there are a couple different types of leptospirosis. Lepto is a bacteria. There's a host-adapted kind of lepto, which simply means it's the kind of bacteria that kind of likes the cow's body cells. And it likes to hide out in those cells and kind of evade the immune response and do its damage kind of on a stealth basis. There's these other non-host-adapted leptos that we're more familiar with, the five-way leptos that we vaccinate animals with forever. You know, those are non-host-adapted, and when they get into an animal, it's usually a big crisis, and the body recognizes it immunologically as well as pathologically, and we can have the late-term abortions and all the effects all the way down the reproductive timeline. This is something that likes to hide out in the kidneys and the reproductive tract, so it's transmitted mostly through the urine and respiratory secretions. It does cause early embryonic death all the way down to late-term abortions in weak calves. Generally, the host-adapted form of lepto, the leptohardia bovis, is something that probably affects heifers more pronounced in a more pronounced fashion than it does adult older cows. So as far as our isolation testing biosecurity for this, we have to realize that leptohardia bovis, this host-adapted one, is very intimate with the cow's cells, and we have a problem with long-term shedding. So that long long isolation period that I talk about for bringing these animals in might not be long enough. So we do have some strategies. Clearing the carrier state with injection of tetracycline is one strategy. Vaccinations have been another strategy that should probably be employed on new animals coming in. Again, these are questions that I do address in the proceedings in a little bit more detail, but probably more importantly, something you ought to talk with your veterinarian and see what you're seeing in those particular area of the country. So that's a real whirlwind tour through some bovine infectious reproductive diseases, and I hope I've given you some things to think about. Realize that when we want to keep things out of our herds, probably the first thing we want to look at, the first risk factor we want to look at is what animals are we bringing onto our farm, and how can we manage them. Again, this isn't something that's going to bring that preg rate up from 5 to 7%. It's going to be something that's going to avert the disaster. Think closely about having an isolation place and a period for those animals you bring in. At least consider that, and maybe move yourself a little farther towards the Fort Knox end of that continuum that I showed on that one slide. That isolation period gives you enough time for a lot of things to happen: testing, acclimation of those animals to your feed, your environment, all that kind of thing. Gives you enough time for all that to happen. And probably most importantly, think about things before you bring those animals home and have a conversation with your veterinarian. What tests should I be looking at, considering these animals and my own particular herd? What kind of tests, if any, should I be considering? What kind of treatments would be appropriate to use for these animals if we're talking about antibiotic injections or something like that? And what kind of vaccination, what kind of schedule should I get on these incoming animals to bring them up to speed with my existing animals? And the answer there might not be that you vaccinate those animals for everything right when they're in the isolation period, depending on the stage of gestation. So with that, I'm going to end and look forward to your questions later on. And I thank you and the organizers a great deal for having me here. Thanks.